Yeah, but like on the topic of adoptees from Asia, like I, you know, I have several friends that I've met, you know, kind of through doing the pod and stuff. They've become really close friends, like, you know, like Adam and stuff.
Yeah, Adam. Yeah, I thought of
like
him.
Adam as an example. I mean, had a great family life growing up here, right? Like he's really close to his parents, and you know, in his, and he was really lucky too because he came over with his brother, his biological brother.
Whoa,
so he wasn't without good. Any. Yeah. You know, blood ties or anything, yeah, even within his own family. And also, I think his parents didn't have their own children. So it wasn't like they were in, you know, I don't know if this is like a dynamic, but like competing with the biological children.
That. My friends, she had that. She had brothers and sisters.
Oh, like biological brothers and sisters.
Biological.
Yeah.
And she was the odd one out.
Yeah, like when it comes to... When it comes to Adam, like I can't think of a more sort of ideal setup where, you know, and they didn't grow up in the sticks. They grew up in Westchester County and, you know, and all that. And he still has an extremely critical view of international adoption.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, yeah, exactly. So I think a lot of this criticism isn't, you know, it's a really screwed up disc. Like the more I learned about it from him, primarily him and some other people I met through him, like, it's you know, it's just an incredibly fucking toxic sort of like conversation that's had about it, because the second, and this is the number one complaint I hear from a lot of adoptees, is when they express a critical view of the system of international adoption, they're immediately told that they're ungrateful shits,
yeah,
because their other option would be to grow up in as a, you know, on the back of some rice farmer's back in China.
Exactly.
You know, like
exactly.
You know, it's really just like it's really like when I hear that, it's really sick. And no matter like how much research they dig up in terms of, you know, because like, especially in Korea, I don't know about China, but generally speaking, these transnational adoption agencies are not, let's say, very ethically run businesses. They still get told, you know, I think that you really need to express a little gratitude. And I've told, you know, I've said this to a number of my adoptee friends. I'm like, you know, in a way, the fucked up shit that you guys experience is like a really amplified and extreme version of sort of like the general treatment and attitude towards Asian people, but it's just much more like I had the privilege of keeping those kinds of forces outside of my, you know, the four walls of my house.
Yes.
You know, but in this case, it's like, you're just totally sort of like exposed.
Exactly.
You know, just totally exposed.
I had exactly the same impression when I was speaking with her. I thought,
yeah,
you know, you have in a distilled form, in a concentrated form, actually, all these, all the bad things about growing up here. I mean, the sort of Asian experience.
And I think really a lot can be learned from them. I think a lot, like I've found that
it is
far from a one-off sort of like niche issue. I mean, there's a lot to decode from their experiences and criticisms about the bigger picture.
Is what
I learned from that.
Yeah, this young person was extremely perceptive. You know, if only, I mean, it very, very perceptive, not just from a personal viewpoint, but almost theoretically, you know, almost from the outside, she could see it as well. Yeah, we have a lot to learn from these people, and it's interesting to see them, to see her come back and you know, make her way here, and settle here. Yeah, incredible.
Well, so, on that front, I think she's part of a larger trend, because I was just hanging out with another friend, with with another friend who you probably know from online. I won't mention.
Yeah. Because,
you
know,
he's, you know, he's also going back to China soon, you know, in a couple of weeks. And I'm like,
oh, another friend. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and yeah. That's on top of, you know, Q, you know, Q, yeah. Q going to Tianjin. And I talked to him, I did a pod with him, and I told my friend, you know, when he's, I think he's going to actually be in the north.
Your friend?
And I was like, when you're there in Dalian, in the north. And I was like, yeah, man, we'll do it. I was like, I should just have a whole series of pods interviewing, you know, people who leave the United States or Canada for China, because I think it's like a very interesting migration outwards, because you're talking about very talented people and people with choices, and they're making a conscious decision to go specifically to China. And I think that's just really interesting, because I'd never heard of this before in my life. I'd never seen a pattern of people leaving the United States for a particular destination, but now it's happening.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. 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 So that's worth tracking if you, come to it. Yeah.
Have you noticed a lot of that in where you are? Have you seen more foreigners coming through, or, you know?
Only through that group, and I don't meet those people very much. You know, there's that Journey to the East WeChat group, right?
Oh, yeah, I heard about that, yeah.
So that's very general, I think, because it doesn't just consist of people who have, you know, who are moving in this particular way for the long term, but I think you also have people who are just who are just coming here for work.
Yeah.
Yeah, they might want to separate that, because it's a very different mindset and attitude, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a lot of American
migration. That was a lot of American versus just doing another, you know, kind of tour, which there's plenty of, right? Mm-hmm. Some sort of 90s thing where you come out here and have a great adventure. Actually, it's really interesting. These are not the times for that. You know, you and I saw bits of that, right? The 2000s, for example. You know, you came out here, you know, where we'd come here professionally to Shanghai, and then you'd see the scene. Well, it's not that kind of place anymore, and we are not those people anymore either. Yeah.
I mean, it's really sort of like stimulating my curiosity to go check out China now rather than later, in terms of just kind of like doing like a bigger scope visit and traveling around.
Yeah.
I almost feel like
it's good to dip in every, you know, couple of years at least every couple of years, because it just moves so fast, so quickly.
Yeah. 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 I figure, you know, because like, because like my secondment is up like next year, like in February. So I'm thinking at that point, like, I had two rounds of a secondment. I had a first secondment that ended in February of this year. But then they offered, you know, they asked me if I wanted to extend it.
Oh,
and I was like, I can't say no to that, right? Mm. So I extended it for another year, but it's very unlikely that such an arrangement can be extended to a third year. So I'm like, maybe next year.
Wow,
would be for me to come and just take some time. Because, like, dude, how many people? Like, think about it this way: like, how many people have the time and means to do a trip like that? Right? Like, It's rare, so I'd be stupid not to like take some opportunity to do something like that I really want to do. You know?
Yeah, you should, man. And it isn't just for, I mean, it's not just going to be an intellectual blast, but it's also about, you know, connections and even work and opportunity, actually. Yeah.
It's just such an abstract idea. I just have to see it. Yeah, I have to see it. Like, people have told me that. So people have quipped about that, saying like, "Oh, you have transferable skills, and there's interesting things for you to work on in China." I'm like, no, I don't think there is.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't believe it, but I think I kind of have to be there to see it. I mean, I highly doubt that, but
I keep seeing stuff you can do. In Malaysia in particular.
Oh, in Malaysia. Yeah,
it's a lot easier in Malaysia in a way, or straightforward, but yes.
I think my advantage is I think some people are looking for you know, business opportunities because they want to, you know, the opportunities are kind of drying up here. Like the tariffs was the impetus for my friend to kind of pack it up here. But like for me, I think I'm ultimately not interested or motivated by any sort of like business or financial opportunity. If anything, I would just want something interesting to do. Well, exactly. Maybe that's easier. Maybe that's exactly. I don't know if that's harder or easier. What do you think? I mean, if I money's not really like the main motivator, is it easier? Because I don't know. I really don't know.
Yeah.
I honestly don't know because,
Well, money will make you do stuff that you wouldn't otherwise, right? So in that sense, quote unquote, easier. But of course, it's easier in the general sense if you're not bound by it, because there's a whole lot of stuff that you can do that you wouldn't otherwise, if maximizing those returns weren't the primary consideration. So,
By the way, I saw in KL, there's this huge, I think, is it the second tallest skyscraper in the world now? Is it under construction or is it completed?
And there's one, yeah.
It's a bit of a glass monstrosity, but I think it houses what seems to be something almost like a Malaysian sovereign wealth fund asset manager or something like that.
One of the government linked investment corporations, GLIC. KL is host to those kinds of things.
I am very curious about KL and Penang.
It's not just finding interesting things to do, but it's an interesting way to be here, right? Mm. Having something to do.
Yeah.
It plugs you in. It's interesting in a way that at least I'm not motivated by. I don't find it as interesting in the West.
Do you think this is sort of like a coming out time for coming out party, or maybe not a party, but like, is Malaysia having a moment right now? Because I was talking with Angelica Ong the other day.
Yes, I haven't heard that one yet. Yes.
Yeah, and she gave an interpretation of Taiwan's recent history that aligned with my view, which was like sort of the 90s, late 80s, 90s is when Taiwan really hit its stride. I mean, making huge gains. And
they were all over the place in Malaysia. Taiwanese business.
She was saying it was an era. You should listen to the pod with her. She had some very interesting takes about it was the era of the Taiwanese businessman who would go anywhere around the world with a suitcase, doesn't matter where. Yep. And he'd be on a plane immediately to strike deals wherever and just be wherever he needed to be. And that kind of person cut a heroic figure back in the 80s and 90s. She was saying, and I think I really agree with this, which is Taiwan's rise was really largely, in large part, the result of sort of like a virtuous competition between China and the U.S. That China was able to bid, like raise the, have them bid against each other to some extent.
Yeah,
and it was virtuous because they weren't fighting each other; they were trying to win Taiwan over, with opportunities. And now the problem, it seems to be, is that has spilled over into outright hostility over Taiwan as a sort of like marital asset in a divorce proceeding.
Now they're in caught in between
you know, and it's like a custody battle over a beloved pet, you know. Malaysia seems to actually be slipping into that kind of into that kind of position now. I feel like, right. I mean, I don't know that much, but it almost seems like for whatever reason, the U.S. doesn't seem to feel like we have a claim on Malaysia the same way we did over Taiwan through...
No, it certainly doesn't.
Our unique history with Taiwan and the KMT, yes. But mm-hmm. we don't have the same sense of an entitlement or ownership over Malaysia, and nor does China. So it's more... Malaysia's like a more remote, truly independent Taiwan, but it has similar capacities and it has similar things to offer, maybe even more because of its population and land size.
Yes, but it's natural resources and so on, yes.
Yeah, but it seems
position,
to be...
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know.
So Malaysia is in a sweet spot vis-a-vis China and the West. Also China and the Middle East and India. So, that's something we work on all the time. I've spent a large part of my career, such as it is, working on this stuff, on ASEAN, via ASEAN. The... kind of the positionality of Malaysia is, of course, set within that of Southeast Asia and of ASEAN as a bridge region. Not just by, as a matter of recent geopolitical expediency, but as something also as a historic role. In fact, it was formed out of this interaction. So even culturally and economically, it's been that kind of a in-between region for a very, very long time. But then if you look at Malaysia as it is now, I mean, if you look at Malaysia, you couldn't be more well-positioned. It's right there, the center of Southeast Asia. It's astride the, it's part of, it has the Malacca Strait on one side and then the South China Sea on the other, right? It's on both east and west of this main chunk of this large chunk of the South China Sea, because don't forget there's East Malaysia. And then the peninsula Malaysia is both part of continental Southeast Asia and also littoral and archipelagic Southeast Asia. It's almost like an island, right? It's this peninsula sort of coming down, and then culturally, in terms of its culture, its Islamic culture or background, it's part of the sort of Malay Muslim archipelago. It includes Indonesia and southern Philippines and southern Thailand. So it's really right in between, but with respect to China
if you expand the notion of the region beyond just sort of East Asia, where I think things were really heavily focused for a while,
yeah, mm-hmm.
and into this larger conception of what I guess we Americans call the Indo-Pacific,
yeah,
right,
only recently,
and even yeah, like any and you zoom out and you include South Asia, you include Indonesia, Australia, and even the even the Middle East and East Coast of Africa, Malaysia's sort of like right in the middle,
right?
And the Strait of Malacca has often been sort of I think it's often been said that the Strait of Malacca is sort of like a global choke point, which is like a very tactical military
that's a very Western way of looking at it. Yeah.
Yeah. But Malaysia, like a choke point. Yeah. Yeah. We could choke the world in this area.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it does infer that I think Malaysia itself is very central.
Yeah.
Like situated in a very central area. Yeah.
It's, you could call it a channel, you call it an artery, but, just referring to it as that choke point immediately puts it into that competitive strategic context, right?
Yeah, it's it's so aggressive.
It's very, very aggressive. It's I mean, I hate the term Indo-Pacific. It's
oh, it's a word.
It only started to come about. It only started to be used about 10 years ago, and we noticed very, very early on. I mean, it has a history, you know, maybe in some sort of geopolitical writing from way before, some German guy talking about this. But as a term for the region, as a geopolitical term, as something in even as an object of study, it's really quite new. So before this, it was Asia Pacific, which was again a new term introduced, right? To the notion of Asia Pacific was meant to include the U.S., right? It was meant to remind you that you know, there were two sides of the U.S. is a Pacific power. Oh, the
Pacific Rim. We also said
Pacific Rim yeah. countries. I mean, all these terms have a history, of course, including Asia. The notion of an Asia, but we had lived into the notion of a sort of Asia Pacific or an East Asia. I like East Asia because there was something to it historically, I would argue. But Indo-Pacific is very, very recent. It's very much part of this pivot to Asia business and the beginning of this containment of China. And in Indo-Pacific, Asia falls out of it, actually.
Right.
Asia, ASEAN fall out of it. And it's basically a military and strategic framing. It maps onto the U.S. PACCOM, U.S. Pacific Command.
Yeah.
So Indo-Pacific has very little reference to how the region actually works. You know nothing about the economy and cultures of the region. And you're only concerned about the strategic rivalry when you use terms like Indo-Pacific. And only then, and it's really largely theoretical and aspirational, because the real stuff, the power in the region, which is economic power primarily, is not around an Indo-Pacific. It's East Asia. It's, if you just look at the numbers, for example, it's Northeast Asia. It's, you know, when I say East Asia, I mean, you know, China, Japan, Korea, and ASEAN.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the north of East Asia, and then you have the south. And they function very much as an economic region. So we go back to the Taiwan, those Taiwanese heroes with their suitcases, right? And before them, this wave of Japanese, business people, these Japanese heroes going around the region, setting up factories and so on. So it's been integrated into the growth of, successively of China, of Japan, Taiwan, South Korea. Right. And then we had our own sort of little tigers up to 1997. You had Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore. So there's a real sense of an East Asian economic vitality that ASEAN and Malaysia are part of. Right.
Let me ask you this question, because maybe we can pivot to what originally sparked us jumping on this pod today. Was you've been working on some AI related policy work and stuff.
Yes.
And
yes.
AI investment and it's become a real. I mean, just the sheer volume in terms of the money involved is eye opening, and that's how we Americans think of stuff. Is I want to see the money. And Trump is in Qatar. He's talking about AI.
Yeah.
And then we're having a trade war with China, and it's about AI. We're talking about Taiwan. It's about AI. Everything's coming down to AI. And why? Like, I've had a lot of like discussions with me, and I've read a lot about the technology itself. Mm-hmm. Not all of it agrees. Right, like there's a lot of different takes as to whether AGI is a thing around the corner, or whether it's actually the closer we get, the more we approach it, the further back it recedes. Mm-hmm. That this whole LLM craze that's going on is sort of a dead end technology, and I don't know.
It's not the skeptics. Only thing, exactly.
Yeah.
So there is a way in which this American money of and finance fixated approach, finance focused approach on AI is misplaced and misleading, but deliberately so. So there's a lot of money going to AI, but is that the best lens to look at it? I mean, then you see Trump's Middle Eastern visit or Gulf state visit as exactly an example of this. I'm bringing home, you know, trillions of dollars in investment, or before that, I'm going to have, you know, half a trillion in for Stargate.
Yeah, that's it.
It's just this financialized bullshit, right? Because chips cost money, right? And data centers cost money, and you just want to pump this stuff up.
Yeah.
And I think it leads you down. It isn't that data centers aren't going to be important and GPUs aren't going to be important, but you're taking, you know, you're looking at it as if that is what's driving it. And you're just barking up the wrong tree, because AI is about a lot more than just LLMs, right?
Yeah. This
computer vision, right?
Yeah.
Like cars, for example, you know, massive use of AI. I mean, I'm talking about, the new cars, the ones that China is good at making, your automated driving, automated vehicles, and self-driving vehicles that are around the corner, and the for the navigation, for the computer vision that's required for them to navigate and so on. That's AI, right?
Military too. I think this is a huge
military. Yeah, you're not going to use ChatGPT or DeepSeek to be running those cars, right? You talk to them through that, but there are other components of AI, other aspects of it. And of course, the LLMs are sexy right now, but that isn't the only thing. I mean, let me get back to the point I was trying to make. And I think it distorts the view, because there's a sort of US financialized Silicon Valley model of technology driven by VCs. It's no longer about engineers, right? It's about the tech bros in the sense of these finance bros we were talking the other day, these all-in podcast types.
Oh yeah, like David Sacks ain't no engineer. I mean, he doesn't know
They're
shit.
Not engineers.
Yeah. He's an MBA. Right? He's a fucking MBA. Like,
how many of those guys are engineers? Or even if they were engineers, how many of them are operating as like engineers?
I think the Olin guys, only one of them, I think it's Friedberg, one of them even pretends to have any real STEM knowledge. And he's more of like I think he was like a bio guy or something. None of them are real engineers or anything.
Yeah. So the way in which these guys are driving this thing is in terms of, you know, those types of returns and that sort of framing.
As influencers. I mean, Sachs is the AI and crypto czar under Trump. He's a real official now, right? Yeah. Driving policy. Yeah.
Is that his actual title? Because on his Twitter, on his X profile, that's what he says. AI.
No, and, yeah, czar. Yeah. No, it's a thing.
AI
yeah.
and crypto czar.
Okay. I don't know. Yeah, we had a. It stems from, I think, the czars that we have. They were like these subject matter experts, and I think it started with a drug czar, like under Reagan. Mm-hmm. I think we had a drug czar to like tackle, illicit drugs.
Yeah, we can talk about it today, because it became very clear that the Trump thing, the Trump strategy now about on AI dominance. Is informed by what Sachs so proudly tweeted out, right? Mm-hmm. The strategy he tweeted out. So here we are at this point. Prior to this, under the Biden administration, they had a kind of diffusion rule, which is a nice way of putting that they're going to put saying that they were going to place countries on a three tiers, you know, allies, right? Friendly countries, I can't remember the exact term, that are okay, and then enemies. Mm-hmm. Tier one, you could share tech. So depending on what tier you were, you were entitled to semiconductor to chips, semiconductors and their technology on a differing basis, right? So the ones that were closest, we could collaborate, etc. And these were strictly the military and strategic allies. And then in between, you'd have quotas, the ones in the second tier. And then on third, restrictions, of course, there would be China, North Korea, Iran, Russia. And of course, this meant that you would restrict the adoption of these chips, because this was all about the control of NVIDIA GPUs, right, to choke off China in the first place, but so that US would maintain dominance with this policy of restriction and quotas. But the Sachs comes along, and of course, Jensen Huang would agree, you win through adoption. That was the idea. You know, the way in which we're going to win and dominate is to have people adopt our stuff, not restrict it. So let's just have as much as possible, but then we then kill off their technology in another way. So that's why you had this dual announcement. In the first place, it was all about, and the timing of it is not accidental, that he came from the Gulf states and then they made that announcement right there and then of these massive Gulf investments in data centers, right? Both in the Gulf, both in Saudi Arabia, for example, and in the US, amounting to hundreds of billions, and commitments to buy, you know, hundreds of thousands of GPUs. You obviously had to lift the diffusion rule to have these countries, which aren't tier one countries, buy as many as they wanted. Remember that prior to this, under Biden, they restricted the number that these guys could have for fear that they would be transporting this stuff, transshipping that stuff, or, you know, diverting, as they say, to China. I mean, the tiered strategy was to control the number that would get to China through...
As if they were sort of like precious...
Contraband. Remember? Yeah.
Yeah. As if they were... Almost as if they were weapons, like...
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
In fact, exactly like they were weapons. They were... under that category, they became security-sensitive, you know, important...
Not out of character for the U.S. to think of technology in that way.
Exactly.
I mean, we thought, for example, like a prime example would be like cryptography. We right. thought of cryptographic tools as weapons, and we put weapon-like sanctions around the export of cryptography.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head.
But that we did that.
This is exactly what I object to in this, and what I think is really harmful in this. You have weaponized GPUs, right? And the AI supply chain, the AI hardware supply chain, not just because it's the hardware where the money is. So their focus is on this. And of course, Dave Sachs and the tech bros are saying, no. You know, it's the opposite. We should have as much of it going out as possible. Then how do you stop it from going to China? Well, we're just going to ban Huawei Ascend, which is exactly what they did. So they had this ridiculous statement from the Department of Commerce.
Let's see. I think you...
Well, I don't know what happened.
Okay, sorry. We cut out for a sec. But yeah, you were saying, we were talking about the danger of this sort of like weaponized approach towards GPUs and AI hardware and stuff.
Right. So the... of course, the danger is more broadly, I mean, AI is critical technology. It's such a powerful technology, and if you use it for, if your perspective is, or if you use it as a weapon, it's going to be the most powerful weapon, of course. But on the other hand, it has tremendous potential it's tremendously enabling, right, for developing countries such as Malaysia. So I'm going to take it from the perspective of Malaysia, and where, you know, this, it's not a question of whether, you know, we take on AI seriously, but how? And a weaponized approach is exactly what we don't want. But I was talking about the contradictions in that approach for US policy. I don't know if we cut out at the point where I was talking about these sort of tiered diffusion regime that the Biden administration imposed, right?
Yeah,
so we got that. So then we got it replaced. Yeah. And it got replaced when Trump visited UAE, Qatar and Saudi Arabia. And wanted to sign those gigantic deals to sell them chips, right? Because they have huge AI ambitions, data center type thing ambitions, and they're going to.
You mean the Arabs do, or yes. the Americans do, or both?
The Arabs do.
Okay.
They have massive AI ambitions. And the chip restrictions under the Biden administration would have made that difficult for them, because tier two countries under that regime.
Let me cut in with a question.
And they would have a quota.
Before we go further down this road, because this is the point in conversations where I always get a little bit lost. What does it mean, do you think? To say we have huge AI ambitions, like in what sense? To own data centers, to create new AI methodology?
That's a really great question.
Create an AI-enabled city. What does it mean to have AI ambitions right now?
Precisely the question people need to be asking. So if all you want to do is build data centers, and we've talked about this before offline, right? I mean, what are you doing? You're setting up these gigantic utilities that draw a huge amount of power and water, actually, and don't require a lot of your workers, and you don't need your own talent base. And this is, you could locate this stuff in the Arctic, right? But if it's just that, then what is that ambition? So they need to ask that question. Do you want to be getting in on developing frontier models, which requires a huge amount of, which requires talent, right, and resources and money? But the data centers are a key enabling thing, having those data centers. Why can't you use data centers located elsewhere? Because then you might have your own rules about data localization. Since I think... So they have these AI ambitions, AI smart cities, right? They want to be in on this technology. And I'm not sure how well specified those plans are, but data centers are a big part of it. They want to, of course, leverage the cheap energy. That's an advantage that they have. So the Biden diffusion regime in which they would have to have a quota, and they would have to negotiate their quota of chips, of these weaponized chips, wasn't ideal for getting the maximum investment from them. So they lifted that and they replaced it with this model that Sachs was talking about, where you're going to have certain allies, right?
to clarify, it sounds like Sachs, from my read of it, and you tell me if I'm misinterpreting what he's saying, but it almost seemed to me that what he was envisioning was, sort of a platform market share war, of the kind that we see between, say, the PlayStation versus Nintendo, or iOS versus
Android.
Android. Where the goal was to maximize usage of the American technology stack,
yes,
including CUDA and at the API layer and NVIDIA chips.
Exactly.
And then ultimately, I guess part of that is to re-onshore TSMC to onshore the actual fabrication of these chips. So it's like a fully American stack. And I'm wondering, aren't those the... and as opposed to like the Chinese stack that's coming out with the Huawei AI data centers and chips and stuff.
Yes.
And is there any meaning to that beyond the sort of like NVIDIA share price type thinking of this? Like, they seem to be really thinking like, oh, let's sell the pickaxes in this gold rush, right? it's a smart business move, but are we really, does this kind of go beyond mere business? And we're talking about something bigger than just market share for NVIDIA tech, you know, chips. And are they being short-sighted? I guess my question is, if that's Sachs's view, doesn't that seem kind of short-sighted?
I think maybe short-sighted.
Even besides the point?
I think it is short-sighted.
In terms of the real technological strategy here?
Yeah.
In terms of building up, you know, integrating AI into all aspects of your society? I don't know.
Absolutely.
Maybe I'm missing it.
No. I mean, you're asking exactly the right question.
Uh-oh. Let's see.
Yeah.
Okay, there you are. Yep.
Okay.
Sorry, I don't know how much of what I said you heard, but...
I heard up to the point where, you know, you asked those very, very good questions, you know. Whether this is misguided and short-term. And I think it's short-term precisely in looking at the technology as a weapon and seeing it in an adversarial win-lose competition against China. Because in both respects, both models are models of control or dominance in some one way or another, right? To win this game against China. Whether it was the Biden era thing of restricting access to chips through a quota system imposed on the entire planet, or this new one where, yeah, we would just drive adoption and just declare the other guy's chips restricted, off limits. Not the other guy's chips and their AI. Right?
Yeah, that it just doesn't seem so, like that's gonna. I feel like the tech industry has long tried to, you know, let the cat out of the bag, but then be able to put it back in whenever it wants with these IP type restrictions and.
They want to go back to before the DeepSeek moment.
Yeah,
they want that moat again, as if, yeah.
But also, it's not. I mean, they're like, how does this work? Because like, if the goal is to contain China's ability to, develop AI, I don't understand. Short of sabotaging, I guess that's what they're trying to do. But
Sabotage has been tried. It doesn't really. Yeah,
it's not, we know. I think really we've resigned to the fact that that's not going to work.
This is the market share one, right? Yeah, this is the standards. We own the standards. CUDA, in particular.
These seem like very low stakes. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, but they're very expensive stakes. I mean, they're high. You know, high investment stakes. There's a lot of money involved, and so they, you know, even strategically thinking about it as a weapon, right? That strategic mindset is corrupted by the money interest in building a moat of money. So now you're just using Arab money to build a moat. But I think how different is this from the strategy before DeepSeek came along and disrupted that whole idea that, you know, your money was the moat. And so now you're just going to use Arab money to it. Then you're going to add in this little, very poorly developed bit about any Chinese competitor or Huawei's chips being off limits, right? Being restricted, being illegal in some way, and their AI models being illegal. Because don't forget, you don't want other people to be running Chinese AI models, training them and using them. So, of course, if the Arabs built gigantic data centers, and they wanted to run DeepSeek there, that would not be ideal for you. You'd advise against that. You would threaten consequences.
This is a ridiculous strategy on our part.
It's not even a, yeah, exactly.
I think because it's not just because the mechanisms to enforce it are so, I don't even think we have such mechanisms. I'm not even sure, like, when it comes to saying, like, it's illegal globally to use Huawei chips. Like, on what basis are you even going to say that? I'm not even talking enforcement. What legal basis do you even have to say this?
Well,
you know, like, wait, the what's the theory here? I don't know any legal basis for this.
Yeah. A couple of days later, I think they took it off and they amended that to an advisory thing, I think. Yeah, but who knows and who cares anymore? Because, you know, legality doesn't matter to them. They don't even pretend to legality.
But okay, so not only does the plan, is it impractical to actually implement, but I don't even understand the purposes of it. Because
exactly.
The only purpose I can see is, one, protect your national champion, NVIDIA, okay, in terms of global mm-hmm. market share. And they see, yes. Oh, we're going to have to compete at some point against, maybe the VC bros are for, like, do have foresight into the upcoming global market share competition with Huawei when it comes to training chips or whatever these things are called. Mm-hmm. But, okay. So you have that in mind, but is that really the goal of this? Like, I feel like the companies in China that are really devoted to creating AI technologies are agnostic. They would love to use NVIDIA chips and not have to burden.
They do use NVIDIA. Yeah.
Yeah. If they could use H100s or Blackwells, they would do it. But you said no, and so you've created a competitor, and now you're. Now your AI strategy has shifted to how to compete, how to maintain market share against this competitor that you forced them to create in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, like, why not just sell the damn chips to China? I don't understand. I mean, if global market share is the point, why don't you just drop the sanctions and just sell to China? Because if they don't use your chips, they're going to use Huawei chips. And then you've got two problems.
Yeah.
One, they have access to AI chips. And two, they're making it themselves and they're probably going to be able to sell it cheaper.
Yeah,
with better performance than NVIDIA. So now you've got two problems.
Yes, exactly.
What's the fucking point?
Jensen
here?
Would be really, really happy if you lifted this and said, "Look, this just you Chinese just use that, right?
Just sell the fucking chips
and
to
then
China.
CUDA
and
would
even
be
China
king
at that point
forever, right? You'd have they
yeah,
would be
I don't
the
get
standard,
it.
Okay." But then the Chinese would be developing their own AI models, right? And their AI models might be better, more efficient than yours and better than yours. Right. And then reach this thing, you know, this singularity point or AGI or ASI. Right. And then they dominate us. So, you know,
what is this stupid thinking? I just don't understand.
It is.
I guess
it's cargo cult thinking. OK, you have on the one side this ridiculous weaponized cargo cult military vision of AI. And then on the other, these tech bros, right, wanting to build a money moat, right, around yes. whatever it is. So the marriage between the national security state, the NetSec state, military industrial complex, and Silicon Valley, right, comes home here, you know. So, and in a strategy that actually, as you really point out very well, is incoherent.
It doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's driving
you know,
a very coherent response from China, though. And the response is very it's simple to state. They're going to build the entire stack, top to bottom. And they're almost there. In fact, in point of fact, they're already there. They're at the top end, they're not as, you know, it's not yet, especially at the chip level, right? In EUVs, for example, they're a few years behind. But it already works. So now you have this problem. You want to stop it from so not, now you want to, the game is about adoption and you want to prevent Chinese adoption. So where's the battlefield now? It's in places like Malaysia. It's in places like Saudi Arabia and Qatar and UAE. And it seems from this visit as if they won over the Arabs. Mark my words, they haven't. Okay.
But won them over to what? Won them over to using
NVIDIA.
NVIDIA. That's
it. And running ChatGPT on it.
And run ChatGPT instead of
DeepSeek. Yeah.
I feel like these are low stakes and it doesn't really matter.
They are low.
And
they are low. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're big money stakes, but they're low AI technology stakes, I feel.
Precisely. Precisely.
You know,
and their games would tell you that that's the only, that is the technology stake. It's in buying this particular product. Right, using this particular product, you're not looking at at your talent pipeline. You're not, you know, at the people, the engineers that are going to be doing this, and you're not looking at the applications. You know, when you talk about adoption, at some point, these guys are thinking of building all this. Who's going to use this stuff? Who's going to use all this compute? For what purpose? You mean just for running chatbots?
Yeah, to piss Whereas off
in China,
your,
yeah.
Remember, piss off your professors. That's basically all it comes down to.
Yeah,
and to giblify everything.
It's a B2C. It's a consumer model that they have in their heads. They're not looking at the industrial chain, because you don't have an industrial chain anymore. You don't have supply chains. China's putting it throughout the supply chain.
Exactly, exactly.
And they don't have any shortage of use for demand for compute. You know, there was a fall off in demand for compute after DeepSeek, right? Even Microsoft said, "Look, I think we've overestimated." I mean, he didn't exactly put it in this form, but they came out and said, "Yeah,
I'd rather lease the space than be a hyperscaler."
Yeah,
right. I don't want to be in the data center.
I don't want to be in on this hype. I want it to be practical and to be real use. Where is the real use? In China, it's almost demand pull rather than supply push, because there is I'm not going to underestimate the supply push here, right? The strategic push, the business push, but there's a huge amount of demand coming in for the AI because they're incorporating it into every kind of thing, and I mean things. You know, the kids here are developing IoT applications.
Yeah.
Right. There's this guy, ex student of mine. I mean, that's what he's doing right now. You know, he's building a smart fridge, you know, talk to you, and he's building, you know, they're building systems that can, IoT systems for the home. So they're already working on stuff like that, and it's all AI enabled. Now, if you're saying that, here's the other incoherence about running Chinese, so-called Chinese AI, if you want to, you now want to nationally denominate it. Okay, fine. You mean I'm not supposed to run like they did with, now they're trying to restrict iPhone from running Alibaba's model, right? Did you hear about that? So the US government found out that Apple, right, intends to run, is in talks to, I don't know what the stage of discussion is, run Alibaba's Qwen model on its phones in China. Because your next generation of smartphones are all going to be heavily AI sort of enabled. So in China, they wanted to use this. And they want to ban, the government wants to ban, stop Apple from doing this. But every app in there is AI enabled. Yeah. So I say, why didn't you stop them from using WeChat, Alipay? You find me a Chinese app, a Meituan or whatever, that isn't AI enabled, because so goes the argument from the government. You just, if you let Chinese people use Alibaba on as the main AI model on your phone, then you're helping them train and improve their AI. We don't want that. Dude, every object that you're going to interact with, every sort of appliance and device is going to be AI enabled. Right, and China is making these items. So then, why don't you stop buying Chinese appliances, which will happen? I mean, it's already happening, right?
It's tactics without a strategy.
It is tactics. It is tactics.
Yeah. With no overarching
strategy.
The
thing is, it's financially, it's monetarily motivated tactics. So even if I were looking at it from a narrow American strategic dominance type of viewpoint, I'd be a bit worried about this strategy. Because
even from that perspective, it's a sort of like reflexive monopolist strategy of lockdown rather than, you know, upstart competitor corporate strategy of growth. And
But like, imagine if you were running a company, right? And you were the CEO and this was the strategy you recommended. If you were like AMD versus Intel, right, back in the day, and you were Intel and you wanted to beat in.
Okay, there you are. You're back.
So we lost me there for a moment?
Yeah, just as you were answering, or just as you were chiming in there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Where was I?
Well, I wanted to run this by you. The point that you made about there being no like deeper, the supply chains that really need AI and the industrial processes that really need AI like aren't really here in America. They are in China. I think that's one of the big issues, right? Like AI by itself without a body doesn't really mean much.
Exactly.
Like intelligence needs a body, right? And this kind of reminds me of, you know, and this is the thing. I think it is cargo cult because that's a really good point that you make. If I'm interpreting what you're saying correctly, as an American, I think I'm part of this cargo cult. Is like we do see AI as a sort of almost mythical recreation of like a godlike like superpower, and we got to be the first to build it before the Chinese do. And we're going to do it. We're going to make sure that his DNA is like American and, you know, NVIDIA.
Exactly.
It's strange.
It is strange. That's not how they see it here in China.
But you know what's interesting is if you took a lesser technology like 5G wireless, that was an example, I think, of a technology that most Americans weren't as hyped about it because 4G for most ordinary users is plenty fast. Like we can watch HD videos without lag. So like, who cares? What else are you going to be doing with it?
This is a great example. And yet it's key to this AI, so-called AI revolution.
Right. So because, we didn't understand.
You need the stack, but you need the networks.
Right.
How are you going to apply the AI? Yeah.
So for example, like flexible, like really sort of like flexible manufacturing facilities that can reconfigure very quickly. They were saying, you know, I was seeing some Chinese reports about this saying like, once you have 5G in the area, like that's a whole thing that you don't really have to worry about anymore is the interconnection. So everything can just talk in 5G and you've got so much bandwidth that you really don't lose a step over, you know, sort of like hardwiring everything into the network. And so it just makes manufacturing facilities really easy to set up and then change and reconfigure.
Exactly. Exactly.
Whereas in America, we don't really think about that. We're just like, why do I need 5G on my phone? 4G is good enough for me to watch YouTube.
Exactly. It's just this consumer thing, right? Because you're not thinking of automating.
Okay, we're back. Yep.
Yeah, where were we? Sorry
about that. Yeah, I just finished my rant about 5G and how like we just didn't we like the America is a consumer society, and so I just don't think we're equipped to think about these technologies in terms of like an infrastructure component of infrastructure and production, you know.
Yeah.
So
that's brilliant. Exactly. It's consumers and financiers. Right?
Yes.
You have the finance guys on one side and then consumers on the other. And in the middle, you just expect it to sort of magically happen. Yeah. You look at what Trump brought back from the Middle East. Okay. So we're going to put all this money in, et cetera. Right. What are you going to do with all that capacity, even if you are able to build it? What is it for? I mean, they don't worry about that because by then they take the money and run.
I mean, look, prior to this whole AI data center craze, we were creating Bitcoin mining facilities that were gobbling
this
up energy.
Not much better than that.
Yeah. For what
it
purpose?
It isn't much better than crypto, the way they're thinking about AI right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it goes with that magical thinking that I told you about, right? So you're bringing up 5G is perfect for this. That's part of the ecosystem you need for AI demand and AI adoption. Because you're thinking about the consumer, right, querying their chatbot. But what about sort of automated construction sites where you have sort of drone trucks, right, going around excavation? You what about automated port facilities? All that requires network. But of course, they cut themselves off from Huawei, from the best, the most advanced networking, and they're trying to make, you know, have other countries cut off as well. That hasn't gone very well. But they're not thinking of the ecosystem, the entire business and industrial chain. So, you know, to that extent, it's really lopsided for the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'd go so far as to say that I think the U.S. has lost the capacity to think about technology in like a fulsome way.
Yeah.
So we can excel still, I think. Like, we do produce really and attract, I would say, probably more attract really great talent, and can produce really cutting edge technologies in specific areas. But I think that there lacks like a sort of bigger ability to think about the future.
Yeah.
In ways that aren't, you know, we're thinking about the future in terms of the growth of a company.
Exactly.
Like one fucking company and one investment. And it's so boring, dude. It's like listening to the All In guys and other VCs talk and just like business, the US tech community talk about technology is just, it's supremely boring and fake and gay. There's nothing else to say about it. It's all hogwash meant to attract investment capital.
It's always someone's pitch book.
Yeah,
it's like reading someone's, what's your thesis, you know?
It's so dishonest.
It's just some guy's pitch book, some guy's thesis. And, you know, imagine if we heard about, now we're talking about $1 trillion investments. What if you put $1 trillion into building high-speed rail? That would do more for U.S. competitiveness, capacity, right? Your total productive and even strategic capacity than $1 trillion into, I don't know, into data centers at this point. So
I might even say I think building the high-speed rail network was a much greater feat than a lot of this AI stuff that we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, and
it's in a lot of very unsexy stuff, though. It's unsexy to finance bros,
right? Because how do you do a train startup? You know, you can
exactly.
You don't.
How do you do a train startup?
You have to have a government corporation do the thing. You know,
you have a government corporation. It's going to be loss making. How do you? Yeah. How do you figure this whole thing out?
Nobody wants to lobby for more Amtrak money. It's not
right. And then you have to have your land acquisition issues. So it's unsexy stuff that actually turned out to be critical in the success of the whole venture.
Oh,
That we have an ecosystem approach.
I think it's very sexy. I just don't think it's profitable in the short term.
Yeah.
So it's, I think you're right. It's not sexy to the MBA who wants a pitch book, you know, who thinks that, you know, real innovation comes from the ability to describe your own idea in less than 15 seconds.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But You know, I was just talking to someone on Twitter today about this briefly, where he was saying he's an American and he was saying that in visiting China, he's really gone down this rabbit hole of looking into these sort of conurbation development plans of the sort of like southern, the Greater Bay area, Shenzhen, Hong Kong, Guangzhou, that whole area.
Yeah.
And then the sort of like the Shanghai, there's one in Shanghai too. I think that, I don't know if Hangzhou's part of that as well. And then this idea that there is an urban.
And the big one in the north, huge one around Beijing.
And Tianjin, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this concept of like these conurbations of like cities at scale, which are sort of melding into super cities of an even greater scale. And, you know, it's funny because I was like, this is something that we used to talk about in the US a lot in mid-century I would put it till about the late 70s, where there was a lot of speculative talk, both like for real, about how the eastern seaboard of the United States was going to turn into a single mega city. And that factored into real discussions as well as our fiction and whatever. But it was part of our imagination to say, oh, if you look at, you know, the eastern seaboard at night, and we were first getting these sort of like space satellite views of the Earth, that cities were sort of like these neuronal cells and they were growing and then eventually they would merge and you would have a bigger structure come out. We stopped thinking in those terms altogether because we just didn't have, I think, the will or imagination to keep going with that. But that's not a pitchable idea. That's not a business opportunity. That's a whole society.
In the US, not as a business idea. I mean, you're good at pointing out that they had an imagination on this scale post-war.
Yes, that's my point. We absolutely did. There was this sort of modernist,
ambitious modernist imagination, which doesn't even exist anymore.
Yeah. It's made fun of. It's mocked.
It's mocked.
Because it's impossible. So instead, I think your description of the cargo cult thing is right. I think ultimately our God is the market.
Yeah.
That we've actually developed a rational, a sort of like quasi-rational worship of financial markets.
Yeah.
And the financial markets, because
your God
nobody
is now invisible. Your God is now truly invisible.
Yeah. You know what our God is? It's a financial Ouija board, right? So everyone's got their finger on the market, but not one person is necessarily in control, or if they are, they won't admit it. And it spells things out, and that's our God. You know what I mean? It's a financial Ouija board.
Yeah. It's really disincarnate, sort of unincarnate theology. There's a God that's just out there. We throw money at the thing. We never have to see the result. And it doesn't have to be incarnated in regular things and or people. So, I it was never clearer than in the announcements, in the way they conducted this thing with the Gulf states. You come back and then you have these $1 trillion investments and they're going to put money here and there. And I'm telling you, you know, this is not going to happen. And if it did happen, nothing would come out of it. Mm-hmm. So without a hell of a lot of other work in putting in the infrastructure. So the contrast, again, with China is that there's real demand for AI. Of course, this problem is much bigger than just AI, but there's real demand coming. And then it's in an ecosystem. It's in an economy. It's in a market that includes space technology, for example, new energy. So they're making advances in energy production in all kinds of areas. So that's, of course, part of the mix. But they're not looking at it piece by piece and not making, you know, this sort of cargo cult out of one particular thing, such as AI. So, yeah.
I think this is a thing where the reason America is going to lose this race to, because one, we don't even know what the race is really about. We don't know even we don't even really know what the race is. And the other thing is like, we're starting to see things, and I'll admit, like, this is true of myself too, just being an American here. We're starting to see things happening at the frontier of technology, which is, we're not even sure why it's being done. So, for example, I read there's news now about China's going to create a supercomputer cluster in space.
Yeah. Yeah. They just launched the first nodes. Yep.
Right, for a supercomputer in space. Mm-hmm. And I got to confess, I have no idea why anyone would even want to do that. I'm sure there's a reason for it. Okay, not only do I not understand the technology, which is sort of like a nodal cluster of compute up in space and whatever, and it said it's going to be an AI enable, or it's going to be an AI power data center. Or
it's not, a data center. It's a data center out there with no heating, overheating issues, right? With super fast communication between the nodes because you're in space. And what is it going to be? What is it going to be processed? But they have other plans, right? They're going to mine the moon. they're going to build solar arrays out there, which will, you know.
I don't get it. It's part of a plan, I know, because usually I don't think China does dumb shit for no reason, right? No, like, I'm pretty confident China has plans around this. But I honestly don't think that we understand what the plan is, and therefore we don't know what the race is. Because I don't understand why you need supercomputers in space. I don't. That just seems like a really random thing to put in space. You know what I mean?
So Well, they may be testing out a new way of doing data centers.
I guess.
Remember, the overheating issue isn't there, right? They're going to probably be powered from
solar.
Right? Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So, okay, they may do stupid things. They're probably bound to do stupid things like everybody else. But you can rule out one source of stupid things: the stock market. Because our stock market here sucks anyway. So nobody's right. doing things to pump up their stocks. Nobody's doing this pitch book bullshit. And secondly, they're not pitching to the military-industrial complex. So if there's strategic thinking or military thinking, that's done in a different way. That's not subject to people like Eric Schmidt, right? Coming and telling them that, you know, they have to be in some, you know, huge... so some race for dominance with the US. If they figure that out, they figure that out themselves. I mean, they figure it out without these hucksters, right, pitching to them and making a buck.
Nor is the Chinese government desperately trying to figure out ways to repatriate offshore RMB at scale, because the government finances situation is getting kind of dicey, you know? So.
Oh, wait, now you cut out.
Oh, okay. That's all right. There we go. Our space, the space data center hit a moon shadow, and you cut out for a sec there.
Okay, yeah.
We gotta get a better platform, dude. Like, there can't be supercomputers in space, and we can't do a podcast. Like, it's there can't be 5G and AI, and we can't talk to each other.
Exactly.
We gotta figure. There's gotta be a better way.
There's gotta be a better way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so you cut out on the repatriation of RMB.
No, I said a lot of the Chinese aren't really worried about repatriating offshore RMB to cover off government finances and stuff. Like, that's not a major issue right now either. So I feel like, our head's not really in this race. We don't even seem to know what the race is. And the things that China is doing has become unpredictable, I would say, to us. Like, because we don't really know what it's for, because you said, we're money brained and consumer brained, but we're not really thinking in terms of like a fulsome picture of the future.
Yeah.
And, you know, Lei Gong just, you know, funny enough, he just put a tweet up in response to one of something I said about that urban agglomeration thing. And he's got a GIF of the movie Minority Report, which I think came out in the 2000s. And that was an era where I remember, like, Steven Spielberg had invited a bunch of futurists, like people who were specifically thinking about what cities and society would look like 50 years in the future. And the movie was made around some of those ideas. He was trying to show us like a realistic vision of the future. And obviously those things are not coming true.
Yeah.
You know, so.
I think you have a very good point here about American imagination, cities dropped out of view.
You know? Yeah.
Industry dropped out of view. I mean, real world material stuff more generally just dropped off. But you're not thinking in terms of building cities anymore or infrastructure anymore. Because if I had, you know, $1 trillion to play with, I'd put a big chunk of it at least, right, into transportation, into urbanization.
Yeah.
But they're not thinking like that. And I don't know why. And I don't know how they expect to win. Maybe, of course, the game isn't just winning. It's winning for them personally. But how the U.S. Wins, you know, with this very, very narrow approach that ends up actually immiserating others. So if you're just immiserating, continuing to immiserate the population, my God, I mean, you know, just think if their data center plans came through and you sunk all that money in and you built sort of nuclear power next to it to run these data centers, what would it be for? What would it run? How would it improve lives? How would it improve manufacturing? Maybe finance? Yeah, you'll run finance on this. You'd have, what, better trading algorithms? I don't know. Healthcare? Is the problem in healthcare, you know, it's something that you can solve with AI? I just don't see what it's for. Okay, on the Chinese side, it's not like there's some sort of devious super brain working out, okay, we're going to, you know, have data centers in space and then we're going to do that. But it's just stuff that seems useful, I think, right? To certain people, you have companies running, let's say, these oxygen methane, for example, this sort of new rocket technology. Very, very interesting. It's a private company. So they're doing that because there's a whole space industry there as well, not as consolidated as in the US under SpaceX, but you have a space industry, you have satellite launchers, but that works together with, that's part of the ecosystem that, that includes AI, that has AI at the center of it. I'll go back to my perspective here from, even though I live in China, policy-wise, from Malaysia, and the predicament that countries such as Malaysia are put in by this rivalry, and the way the U.S. in particular is pursuing this rivalry, first by attempting to restrict the flow of chips, so you have that blockade, and then by trying to by putting pressure, just as they did with Huawei and 5G, not to adopt anything Chinese. So these small countries or medium-sized countries are put in a tight spot, increasingly under U.S. pressure. I don't know how effective that pressure will be, but you're constantly having to assert your sovereignty, to pursue your own best interest against this sort of pressure to conform to U.S. containment strategy. And much of it is irrational from our own perspectives. You take AI, yeah. You take AI, very clearly AI. Who doesn't want to run DeepSeek rather than ChatGPT? It's not that you won't have both. It's not an all or nothing choice. But for many purposes, this stuff is it's free. You can adapt it. It's open source. You can build application layers on top of it. It removes, right? It lowers the cost of entry, the barriers to entry for all these other countries that aren't able to develop their own frontier models. And it's enormously important that we're able to do this, to have some degree of sovereignty over not just the data, but over the intelligence that comes out of it. Because, as important as we find out almost retrospectively, tech sovereignty was, digital sovereignty was. Remember that whole early period when everybody just adopted Facebook and, Twitter and et cetera, right? Without thinking about it. And then you ended up like Europe without any sovereignty, any control over their information ecosystem, sure. Over their media. Yep. So this time, AI is, several orders of magnitude more powerful than that. Because the training set, what it does, it's going to be fairly opaque at the operational level, what AI is doing. So you definitely want to be locating that data. You want to have AI sovereignty. Now, if you're going to develop that, but you aren't allowed to use the most powerful open source models, then what? You mean you're forcing us to buy NVIDIA and use ChatGPT, Gemini, or whatnot? No way, right? It's a very, it's not a choice that, between sovereignty and, this degree of conformity. Have they thought it through what they're asking these countries to do?
Let me, and I know you have a hard stop at 11, but maybe we could break here and then do like a short bonus episode where I want to follow up with a question as to like what is the role that these third countries think they're playing in the bigger picture. Let's get to that, and so we'll end this episode here, and then we'll if you want to hear the, I think we'll do a shorter bonus pod, but if you want to gain access to that, go to patreon.com/planemag.
Thank you.